And our talk shows are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Noreen Ehrlich, and welcome to Defy and Hustle Radio. I think we got off from a little tripped up start there, and Bob Small, who's across from me here managing the controls here at the studio, does not look pleased about that. So
not at all.
Not at all, right? No. How many years have you been at the studio, Bob?
Let's not talk about that.
No? Okay. All right, well, everybody, it's a beautiful day here in Greenwich, even with this snow squall that just happened and turned the whole place white. But we do have a wonderful show and a great guest ahead. I first want to tell people who are local about, well, there's two events coming up. One's for people who are local. It is going to be at Blackstone Steakhouse here in Greenwich, Connecticut on Saturday, January 4th. At 11 a.m. till 12:30 p.m., and it's going to be a 2020 vision quest. That means we are going to write down our goals for 2020 and also figure out some of the things that maybe we have to release from our lives, some of the obstacles we may be facing, and how we can start to take action. And I really like the idea of a 2020 vision quest, because when we do get to our guest, he's somebody who really, really took his business forward, and he's going to talk to us about that. The other workshop that I'm holding is an online workshop, which begins January 14th, and that will be via Zoom. And that will be meeting once a week for 5 weeks, plus each day you'll get an email into your inbox that will give you practices to do each day, and that is called Find Your Voice in the Workplace and Expect Respect. So there seems to be a theme out there now where people are starting to really speak up more, and so that's a great course. You can check that out on my website, defyandhustle.com. So with all that behind us, if you want to come down to Blackstone's, by the way, January 4th, just show up. I'll probably put it on Eventbrite, but there are a lot of people showing up so far, so it should be a lot of fun, and it should be very powerful. Okay, so I have on the line from Palm Beach, Florida, my next guest, and his name is Dan Wise, and Dan is he started an organization called Federal Prison Time Consulting, and he is also he also has his own YouTube channel called RDAP Dan, and he is going to talk to us about how he became a Federal Prison Time Consultant and much more. So, Dan, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for being on the show with us tonight. How's everything down there in Palm Beach?
Can't complain. Beautiful weather. I unfortunately came down with a cold late yesterday, so I'm battling that. But other than that, everything's great.
All right. Good, good. So Dan, tell us a little bit more about your business, Federal Prison Time Consulting, LLC, and also about your YouTube channel.
Absolutely. So we are a federal criminal defense consultant firm that works with mostly nonviolent first-time offenders that are preparing to go into the federal prison system. Maybe they were just indicted or they're under criminal investigation. We work with them and what they can do early on to not only prepare for what prison could be like, but what they can do to take mitigating steps now to potentially reduce their sentence through different levels of accountability and acceptance of responsibility for what got them into this situation.
And why does the system need something like that? Don't they have their attorneys advising them, or what is it you're offering that, for example, their attorney couldn't?
Sure. So not to mistake with what attorneys do with what we do, because we are not here to claim or to act like an attorney. We completely do the opposite of what attorneys are working on. Our job, what we've realized going through the system myself, is there's a huge gaping era of what to expect, what's next, how to properly prepare from the time that you actually get in trouble to the time that you potentially start your prison sentence, which can be several months or even in some cases, several years. So most attorneys, really what they're focused on is what they can do to help you get the best possible plea deal possible, unless you're potentially going to go to trial. So their job is really digging through the facts of the case, going back and forth with prosecutors, the U.S. Attorney's Office, finding out what they can do to get you the best plea deal, where our job is to mitigate outside of that. What can we do to help you get a sentence that's going to be lower than the guideline range? Also help you accept the terms of the reality of what you're facing, the fact that you are facing prison. What are you going to tell your children? How are you actually taking accountability? What type of letters are you going to be preparing for the judge? How are you possibly preparing for what's called the pre-sentence report, which is done after you actually take a plea deal? There's a lot of things that the attorneys don't go over with clients, and I don't think it's because they don't want to. I just don't think it's something that attorneys understand what somebody's going through unless they've actually gone through these footsteps themselves.
And how are people even finding out? I know that there's a few companies, I guess you would say companies, offering this kind of service now nationwide, but are the attorneys hiring you, or how are people finding you?
It's a combination. We do get hired from criminal defense attorneys directly to help with their clients. They see the value and the benefit of what we do, and it can really help them put benefit into their client of giving them the peace of mind of knowing what's next. But mostly, the way people find us is through our YouTube channel, believe it or not. Prior to starting my own prison sentence, and we can get into that in a second, I'll let you kind of guide that question.
Okay.
But prior to my own prison sentence, I posted one video prior to going into prison about my own experience, what it was like on pretrial, waiting to find out what was next, and just the level of anxiety and the sleepless nights that I dealt with, many, many questions that my attorney just wasn't capable of handling. I decided to post a video on YouTube, and once I released home from federal prison, that video had quite a bit of traffic and questions from people going through exactly the same footsteps that I was going through, that I just thought, hey, this would be a pretty neat hobby to start responding to some of these questions. And lo and below, it turned into a full-blown career several years later.
And the video you put out there was an emotional plea, or was it a complaint? Was it an emotional plea about what you were going through?
I would probably best describe it as a rant. I was sentenced to 42 months in federal prison. I don't know what to expect. I somewhat told my story from the point of view that I had at that point, which was very, very much not a true level of accountability. I was still very much in the blaming phase, blaming everybody else for my situation. I felt like if I had more money, I could have gotten out of this. I felt like at this time, I felt like the government was just targeting me. They were picking on me. Really, I was not ready to take responsibility at all. And a lot of that had to do with owning my own trash that I had, made it really tough to say what I did out loud, because that would have made it real. And that means I would have had to come clean with my kids and tell them I knew exactly what I was doing, and I'm going to prison because of it.
Okay. So let's get into your story, because it is a fascinating story. You connected with me on the internet. That's how I found you. And actually, I didn't even notice for a while, because sometimes I'm so poor about checking on my Facebook Messenger. But when you wrote your story to me, you told me that you had gone to prison because you worked in Savannah, Georgia, where a good portion of my family is, at what is termed a pill mill. And so why don't you tell our listeners about what a pill mill is? Why don't you just start there? And if you want to go into how did you end up at a pill mill in Savannah, Georgia?
So in 2010, I was living in South Florida, West Palm Beach, Florida, I had a small call center where I was doing debt consolidation. And the call center that I had, it was just about five guys that I had working with me. We weren't really making, we were making just enough money to pay the sales reps and to pay a little bit of the overhead and not much more left after that. I was renting my office space inside of another call center that was, I don't know, they were doing a little bit of everything from magazine sales to pain cream prescriptions, you name it, they were probably selling it. And I would constantly overhear the owners of this office talking about how they were getting ready to open a doctor's office in Savannah, Georgia, where, and all I kept hearing was all of the money that they were going to make. They were talking millions of dollars of a year coming through this business, and they needed to hire key people that they could trust to help facilitate this and help run this business. So I started inquiring, kind of pushing myself through, finding out what they needed, what they were looking to hire. And after pushing myself around in there enough, one day, one of the owners, this guy named Lou, came up to me and said, hey, would you be interested in managing our office in Savannah, Georgia, a little city called Garden City? I asked, what would it entail? And he basically said, well, you'd be the office manager overseeing the day-to-day operations, making sure everything runs smoothly. And I explained at that point, I said, look, I would love this opportunity. However, I've never worked in a doctor's office before, so I don't really have any experience. And that's when he said, that's not a problem. We're going to have plenty of medical staff there. They'll be able to train you. We're more concerned with having somebody that we can trust, that can deal with people, and that's likely not going to steal pills or money from us. And I said, okay, well, maybe I'm your guy. So at that point, they gave me the offer. They offered me to move out to Savannah, Georgia to take this position. They were promising me $10,000 a month plus all of my expenses paid. I explained to them that I had small children that lived in Florida, so I would need to come back to Florida on the weekends, which means I needed to maintain a residence in Florida as well. So they agreed to pay for my residence in Florida. They agreed to pay for my residence in Savannah, Georgia. And they also agreed to give me a salary of $10,000 a month. I also explained to them that my girlfriend at the time, who was living with me, I was not prepared to leave her behind. So they said, well, you're more than welcome to hire your own team. We're also going to need somebody to answer the phones, a receptionist. So they allowed me to hire my girlfriend and my best friend, which we all ended up moving to Georgia together, to take on this operation of working at a pain clinic. I knew a little bit about pain clinics at that point. I was not well perversed in it as I am now, or that many others were then. Prescription drugs was never really something that I truly understood, at least not the epidemic side of it.
Were you ever using drugs or any experience with this at all?
Not with pills, no, just marijuana and alcohol. I'd never experienced with any type of Schedule II narcotics or pain pills.
And the pain pills that they were giving at the pain, it was the East Health Center in Savannah. This was oxycodone?
Oxycodone, Percocet, pretty much every no-no pill you can imagine that's been out on the street, that's pretty much all that they were prescribing.
Oh, God. Okay, and I want you to keep going with the story, but was this a national organization? I mean, they sound like right off the bat they're offering you a lot to go and move to Savannah to take care of your family or to take care of your home back in Florida and also pay for your expenses. It didn't look like a very large clinic. So did you find it suspect? I mean, were you suspect off the bat, but just into the money aspect of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just completely turning a blind eye to every warning sign that was written on the wall. First off, the guys that were offering me the job, it felt like a scene out of Goodfellas. They just seemed very, very almost mafia connected. They were good old boys. One of the guys that was involved with all of this was managing a large pain clinic in Florida, and that's what gave them the idea. They saw all of the money that was coming into this pain clinic, so they immediately thought they could replicate this in Savannah, Georgia, which was a cutoff line because most of the patients that were coming to Florida to get their prescriptions were coming from, like, Kentucky and Ohio. A lot of them were coming from Georgia. So they felt if they go open up a pain clinic in Georgia, they would start marketing to all of the pain clinics in Florida, basically they would have us weeks before the actual pain clinic opened. My job changed from office manager to I was basically the guy to go out and look for business. So what they had me doing was going to all of these other pain clinics and stalking out cars that were driving from out of state to this clinic, basically flagging them down on the interstate, getting them to pull over, which seems like, what the hell was I doing? Flagging them, pulling them over and telling them, hey, next time you need to come see your doctor, instead of driving all the way to Florida, here's a place in Savannah, Georgia, right off I-95. We'll give you your first visit free, and it's going to be a cheaper price than what you're paying now. I mean, it was just a real hustle.
And how old were you?
I'm terrible with numbers, so that was
generally.
Early 30s.
Okay. So I'm just fascinated. So I know I'm even going off script a bit here, but I'm just fascinated. So you get to Savannah, and so you, I'm getting the sense you pretty much knew what was going on here, but this was, based on some of the research I did before the show, it does seem like Georgia became a hotspot. Florida had been a pill mill hotspot prior to this. West Virginia, where we hear about just where towns are smaller than the number of pills they're putting out there by exponentially, these are just huge hotspots for these pill mills, and that they're operated pretty overtly.
Yeah, what happened in Florida is the laws changed. This is why everybody started going out of state. The laws changed in Florida to where the pain clinics could no longer, they could prescribe the pills, but they couldn't fill the pills on site unless it was a doctor owned and you jumped through additional hoops. So a lot of these pain clinics, a lot of the money they made was not just writing the prescriptions, but it was also filling the prescriptions. So in Georgia, that law hadn't passed yet. So they tried to get to Georgia to beat the wave to where they could actually write prescriptions on site and then also fill them, because, you know, you're selling a pill that might cost you a dollar and through insurance, a dollar to you. And then through the insurance agency, you might be getting, you know, $15 to $20 for that same pills. And you're selling 90 to 300 pills a pop.
Wow.
It's basically legalized drug dealing.
Wow. It's a lot of money. So, okay. So I want to say the feds busted East Health Center in Savannah in 2011. And then you accepted a plea deal in 2014, correct?
Correct. Yes.
And so... so now you became you've got a company called Federal Prison Time Consulting. What happened during the period when the place was busted by the feds and 2014 when you accepted a plea deal? I assume this is where you learned everything that you now help other people with. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about what you learned?
Sure. So originally when they first came in 2011, they hit the pain clinic, they hit our houses. I wasn't there. They had sent me to another office that they just started to open in Atlanta, Georgia. So I just happened to be out of town when everything really, really went down. Couldn't get a hold of anybody on the phone. Nobody at East Health Center was answering the phone. So we knew something was up. And then the feds came out of nowhere to Atlanta. They found out I was in Atlanta, and they basically surrounded me with about 20, 30 agents with automatic weapons.
Oh my God.
I was just pulling out of the parking lot in a rental car. And somebody walked up to my window and tapped their hand on the window and said, "Hey, Dan," almost as if they knew me. And as soon as I acknowledged it was me, it was just like they came out of the woodwork. Immediately arrested us. They brought me to a county jail in Georgia. And that's where it all kind of started. I bonded out in Georgia. I had not actually been indicted at this point. I was just arrested and then released. And I fought my case from 2011 until late 2013. And when I say fought my case, I originally had a federally appointed attorney. So in the federal system, just like the state system, if you can't afford an attorney, they'll appoint one to you. And the difference is in the feds, when they appoint an attorney to you, you usually get a pretty decent attorney appointed. So when they finally did, a couple of years later, come down and offer a plea deal, and my attorney explained to me that the plea deal they were offering was 52 counts. If I pled guilty, I'd plead guilty to one count of conspiracy. And that one count of conspiracy would carry a max of 60 months, where originally I was looking at 20-plus years with the 52 counts. So when I found out that I was actually facing prison time, even with the plea deal, this is when I went into deep denial, thinking, well, this is because I didn't hire an attorney. This is because I have an attorney appointed to me. I borrowed money. I sold everything I owned, and I ended up hiring a private attorney, and I fought it for another year. And same outcome ended up. I ended up taking the same exact plea that I could have taken, you know, a year earlier with a lot less stress and a lot less sleepless nights. I had my door kicked in again. This time I was arrested. I was indicted. I was brought to county jail in Florida. It was just every step of the way was so hard to navigate, because unless you've been through this before, or unless you know somebody that's gone through this before, the things that matter don't matter, and what you think matters doesn't matter. So for an example, I kept thinking, well, the judge is going to see that I'm a decent person, and somehow the universe is going to correct itself, and they're going to realize I don't deserve to go to prison. They're going to see that I have two small children that need me at home, and this is only hurting them. I went through all these reasons to justify in my mind why I shouldn't go to prison, and never once did I think about the role that I played working at a pain clinic. Even though I wasn't the one writing the prescriptions, the role that I was playing working there was allowing very, very strong drugs to go into the wrong hands of individuals that were going back out onto the streets, that were getting sold, they were getting snorted, they were getting shot up. And how many potential families and children's lives did I ruin turning a blind eye to try to make a couple of bucks? These were the things that I did not focus on going through the early on stages.
And you just didn't have the emotional capacity to realize, you were just in denial. You didn't have the emotional capacity to realize your responsibility in this that got you into the situation.
I think many criminals,
I don't know for sure, but as I imagine a lot of people who get into tough situations don't realize they're part of it. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, you're absolutely right, because the minute you start to look at yourself and you start to take responsibility and own what you did, it's a real hard pill to swallow, because it really does kind of unmask what a scumbag I really was at that point in life. And owning that and saying that out loud then, I wasn't capable of doing it. It was so much easier to just tell everybody what I wanted them to hear. Oh, I had no idea. I didn't know the doctor was doing this. You know, it was easy to play the victim, even though I don't really think anybody actually believed me, because once they saw the story on the news and they read the articles, it's kind of like, how did you not know? How did you not know all these patients were driving? You know, why did you think patients were driving from Kentucky or Ohio to come see a doctor in Georgia? And I would just say, well, I didn't know. I wasn't there long enough, and I didn't understand what I was getting myself into, and I was going to leave. I mean, I had every excuse under the sun. And the reality is I just didn't want to go to prison, and I was so selfish and mad that I had gotten caught in that predicament that I was willing to chew my way out of any hole that I got myself in, if possible. And I realized it's impossible to get out of a situation when you're that deep into it. There is nowhere to go except down.
Okay, good. So stop there for a second, Dan. We're going to go to break, and when we come back, I want you to start to talk about the other side of that now. But we're talking with Dan Wise from Federal Prison Consulting, LLC. He's RDAP Dan on YouTube, and we'll be right back.
Good evening. If you're traveling the northbound Connecticut Turnpike, we have an hour ride north to get from the state line in Greenwich up to Route 7 in Norwalk. Not much better on the Murrett. The northbound Murrett, a 55-minute ride from Greenwich up to Norwalk. You can change the world for a child in extreme poverty through Compassion International. Just text CHILD to 83393 to find out how. I'm Jay Trelace in the 1490 WGCH Traffic Center.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Snow showers ending tonight, becoming mostly cloudy, breezy, very cold, 10 to 15, wind chill near zero. Mostly sunny, breezy, and cold, 25 tomorrow. Then tomorrow night, mostly clear and cold, 10 to 15. Wind chill, single numbers, and sunny on Friday with temperatures around 30. Saturday, mostly sunny with a temperature of 32. I'm meteorologist Bill Jackwoman on 1490 WGCH.
What if I told you I could change your life in just 100 days? This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defy and Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and leader in Wall Street's fast-paced private equity industry. I helped guide teams of professionals to improve their careers, grow their businesses, and still maintain work-life balance. Based on this know-how and my unique understanding of life's principles, I created a 100-day plan that will unquestionably up-level your life. Make 2019 your year. You can and deserve to have it all. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at noreenerlich.com or calling me at 475-333-2173.
Hi, this is Sam Romeo, host of Greenwich Matters, wishing you and your family a merry, merry Christmas and a happy new year. Happy holidays from 1490 WGCH.
To Defy and Hustle Radio. This is Noreen, and our guest tonight is on the line from Florida. It's Dan Wise from Federal Prison Consulting Time, LLC, and he's also known as RDAP Dan on YouTube. So, Dan, you're there still, right?
Yes, I am.
All right. So, Dan, prior to the break, you were telling us how you got into trouble, and ultimately, you did go to prison. We didn't get there yet, but I wanted you to talk about, you went to prison and then you developed RDAP Dan on YouTube first, or did you develop the company first?
So I created a video 3 days before I turned myself in September of 2014. So September 20th, 2014, I put a video on YouTube just titled, "I'm Going to Federal Prison." And I self-surrendered September 23rd, 2014, to start my prison sentence. Throughout my prison sentence is when I found out about the RDAP program, the Residential Drug Abuse Program, which I was able to qualify for due to my substance abuse use of marijuana and alcohol. And taking this program, it's a 500-hour course that you take while you're in prison. And if you successfully complete the program, it can reduce your sentence by up to 12 months. So I was able to take advantage of this program, go through it. It was probably the hardest 10 months of my entire life, but I successfully navigated the program. And then when I released from federal prison, while I was in the federal halfway house, I was working for a friend of mine who had a company in Florida while I was living in Washington. He had a company called Fit Food Fresh. It was a meal prep company. And I was working from a satellite office doing sales and customer service on East Coast time. So I had a few hours in the day after my job where I would check my email, and this is when I noticed I had all of these emails from that first YouTube video that I posted, and all these emails came through while I was in prison. Most of them were emails from first-time nonviolent offenders getting ready to potentially go to prison themselves that all had the same questions, fears, anxiety that I had. So I thought it would be a pretty neat hobby to start posting response videos during my downtime. And that's kind of how it started, was just as a hobby, posting videos online, responding to comments.
What kind of crimes? It was funny because when I was telling people about the show tonight, I don't know if it was funny, that's not the right word, but people were trying to differentiate what qualifies as a white-collar crime. So what kinds of people do you help with your programs?
Well, white-collar is definitely a big portion of it, but it's not just white-collar. I would say it's also blue-collar, but the majority is going to be mortgage fraud, bank fraud, wire fraud, embezzlement, healthcare fraud. We have a lot of doctors, a lot of attorneys, sorry, my mind just drew a blank there. A lot of accountants. Then we also have, you know, people that worked at these companies that maybe turned a blind eye, or they were dealing drugs, large marijuana cases. Nonviolent is really the key factor in first-time offender, not necessarily white-collar. Anybody that's going through the system for the first time are people that would start doing searching on the internet, and they would come across my YouTube channel.
Okay, and it's Residential RDAP, Residential Drug Abuse Program. You said it was the hardest what, 10 months of your life that you went through it in prison? What's so hard about it?
Well, when you hear about the program, the way you just read it, you would almost assume it's going to be something like an AA or an NA or one of the 12-step kind of classes. That's how I imagined it, and I thought to myself, well, I'm just Dan Wise. I bullshit everybody. I'm a master manipulator. I'm going to go to prison and just bullshit my way through this to the point where I'm going to get a quick year off of my sentence. So I had no idea what I had engaged myself in. What I came to find out is, yes, it's a drug program, but the drug program had actually very little to do about drugs and alcohol, and it was more about cognitive skills, CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, taking responsibility for your actions, holding each other accountable, focusing on consequences, identifying what your flaws in your ID and your makeup is. It was a real rude awakening, because every time I thought I could pull the wool over one of the staff members' eyes, what I didn't realize is they had seen a million people just like me come through the door before that was going to try to run the same game, and they saw me coming a million miles away. They would constantly call me on my BS. They would hold me accountable. So many times I was faced with possibly being removed from the program if I didn't start making corrective behaviors in my attitude. And it was about 60 days into the program where I had to really sit down, and I remember it was a senior peer, meaning an inmate that had been in the program for about 3 months longer than me, but he'd been in prison for about 20 years. And I know this sounds funny. I swear to God, I can't make this up. His nickname was Bubba, but not like the Bubba that you would imagine. It was like a just really cool, older black dude. And he came in my unit, in my cell, and he sat down, almost real angry. And when you're in RDAP, everybody refers to you by your last name. So he sat down in my bunk and he said, "Wise, why are you in this program?" And I'm just thinking to myself, what do you mean? He's like, "There's so many people that would kill to be in your spot that have got a lot longer sentences than you do. And here you are acting like a fool, thinking you're going to get over on everybody. Every time you get an opportunity to try to run a game on somebody, you're the first person jumping out there trying to do it." He's like, "If you're going to waste everybody's time, just drop out of the program and let somebody else take an opportunity that will actually use it, that can find a way to better themselves so when they get out, they can stay out, because you have another bit in you, Mr. Wise." And he got up and walked out of my room. He said it much angrier than that and a little scarier. And I just remember thinking there that night, I was a little angry. I'm like, this guy doesn't know who I am. What the F is his problem? But the more and more I stewed on it, the more and more I realized that I really did want to get home. And doing things my way is not working. So maybe the way I've always done things isn't working. So I kind of had to give up control and give up the reality of I'm not in control of my own thought process, because I'm making the worst decisions I've ever made in my entire life, even here in prison while I'm being watched 24/7. So I just kind of slowly started changing my mindset. I started reading positive books. I read a book from Tony Robbins, Awaken the Giant Within. Mm-hmm. And it really resonated with me on a deep, deep level to where I felt, for the first time in my life, I felt like the piece of shit that everybody else had identified me as. But I knew there was better in me. I knew I could do better if I put my mind to it.
Good. Very good. I mean, really, it takes seeing the world 180 degrees differently than you saw it before, because I was talking to somebody about commitment, and there's no such thing as a 99% commitment. It's either 100% or not at all. If you're going to change something, you got to change it. You got to commit to it. You got to stick with it. I want you to talk to us about federal prison time consulting. What do you help your clients navigate? I know you got into it, but talk to me about some of the questions or what they're going through emotionally. Or I know you work with a coach at Federal Prison Time Consulting. I'm trying to remember. It was short.
Jenny Good.
Yeah, the success method with Jenny Good. So why don't you talk to us about what you help your clients with?
Sure. So a very typical client that would reach out to us typically would start off with, "I'm going through a federal indictment, or I'm part of a federal case, and I want to see if you can help me, A, prepare, or if you can potentially help me reduce my sentence." Everybody that engages, of course, they initially, their main focus is, A, either not going to prison at all, or B, reducing their sentence as much as possible through techniques that maybe their attorney hasn't explained to them. So yes, their intentions initially are 100% to shorten their sentence. However, working with these clients, we ask them, you know, questions about their children, their families, and of course that becomes a big part of it. They have little kids. They don't know what to tell their children. A lot of them are preparing to lie to their kids. They're going to say they're going to be going away to work, or they're going to be going to the military. They're not at a level of acceptance for what they did, and they're taking almost zero accountability other than the BS plea agreement they're taking to get a shorter sentence. But beyond that, they're not really taking much accountability for what they did. So they look like every other person getting ready to go in front of that judge. So part of the success method is getting them to own what they did and getting them to openly talk about it. So we involve them in groups. We get them to engage with giving back to the community, where maybe they'll go to either church youth groups or they'll go to troubled youth schools, middle schools, high schools, and they'll talk about what they did. We get them to own what they did. So we ask them, so tell us what you did in your crime. And when they start talking about it, you start hearing what they actually did and what they're taking responsibility for, but they just don't want to admit it to themselves. So getting them to open up and realize that this was a choice that they made, that is it fair that they're going to prison? Is the prison sentence fair that they're receiving? Maybe, maybe not. We're not here to pass judgment on that. What we are here to discuss is what could you have done different if you were to do it over again, and focusing on the consequences and the responsibility of your actions really does start to open one's mind into going, oh my God, I really did put myself in this situation, and I've been preparing to put myself in the situation for years. So working with them on the letters that they're going to be navigating and crafting, that's going to be given to the judge on the level of accountability, is really where Jenny, our certified life coach, she works very, very closely with all of our clients in where their mindset was when they were doing what they were doing and where their mindset is now, on the level of what they're doing to atone for what they did. Because there's a big difference in saying I'm sorry versus showing you're sorry.
And do you actually, you and Jenny, actually try to hold some accountability to see if people are shifted or accepting?
Oh, yeah. You'll see it.
The self-deception?
You'll see it almost every single client.
Uh-huh.
Almost every single client, several weeks or a couple of months into the program, they'll start telling us some of the feedback that they've gotten. Like, a lot of our clients go speak at a lot of different youth rallies and youth groups within their own community. And when they start hearing the stories that come back to them from either the people they're talking to directly or family members indirectly that have gone through something similar, saying, I wish my family had heard something like this before they got themselves into a situation, or I just lost my father to a lifelong sentence of imprisonment, and I wish that my father was taking this kind of responsibility. They start asking the same type of questions to them that a lot of my clients will start asking me. A lot of my clients will ask me, Dan, you went to prison, you came out of prison, and you don't seem like somebody that has lost their mind or like your life is over. You seem like you have an upbeat attitude towards life. How did you get to this point? So they start to see that prison's not going to be the worst thing in the world for them. They start to see that prison can become an experience where they can use this time where they're not going to have cell phones, they're not going to be connected to social media. They can really use this time to internalize and start changing their mindset and building the roadblocks that they're going to need to be the person that they want to be in the future, teaching them that you can't be who you want to be and be the person that you were at the same time. At some point, you got to cut ties and start working on whatever identity is that you're trying to create. That process is not an immediate change. It takes time for these roots to take place. So once these clients and the individuals start to understand this, getting the reduction in time becomes a secondary. They really start to thrive and benefit off of the positive feedback that they're getting from their community. And this is probably the first time that most of them have ever been open and honest about their flaws and their shortcomings ever in their entire life. And some of these are high-level CEOs of organizations and companies that never would have been this vulnerable in an environment if they had not gone through something that seemed to be the absolute worst situation in their entire life.
It is interesting that some of our most successful people in business and just in life in general are often the ones that have a deep level of self-deception, and because they're getting accolades from the community for making money, for example, they they don't even realize that their behavior is possibly hurting themselves and hurting the people that love them.
Yeah, they really do deal with this unacceptable behavior, but they're so used to doing it because they stroke the checks, everybody bows down to them.
Right.
They're used to being the man, they're used to making all of the controls and all of the decisions. And when they get wrapped up in this government conspiracy, whatever it is that they're dealing with, it's very hard for them to realize that they no longer have that control. A lot of our high-end clients, when we start talking to them about who's going to write the letters on their behalf, who's going to be their character reference letters, they start throwing these big names. They start going, well, we have a senator that's willing to write a letter. We have this guy that's going to do it. And when we try to explain to them and say, look, this is exactly what the judge is expecting. The judge is expecting you to throw out all of these big names that you know, like it's going to get you some push or pull. All it's going to do is tell the judge exactly what he was already thinking, that you haven't learned anything. You need to realize that you don't have that type of control here, that the judge doesn't care about your powerful friends. The judge needs to know that you're getting a – the reason why you're going to prison is you need to learn a lesson for what you did. You need to pay a price. And the more you can show that you've taken that accountability and that you've learned a lesson, and the more likely that the judge understands that and sees what you're doing that's different from the average person – the more likely that they're going to believe that you've actually learned something from this, and maybe you don't deserve such a harsh sentence. So getting people to put in that work and that effort is probably the single hardest thing that we do, and that's why we have the weekly coaching going on with these individuals. There's assignments that are given to them. There's expectation. There's letters that they have to write and receive from loved ones. We'll ask them for a couple of loved ones' information, and then we write a letter to the loved one asking them what this has done to them, especially the wives and the spouses. You'll talk to a lot of these husbands that are getting ready to go to prison, and when you ask them, well, how's your wife dealing with this? Oh, my wife is fine. She's fine. She's a trooper. But when you talk to the wife one-on-one,
she's a trooper.
You ask her, like, hey, how does this really make you feel? This was your husband. This was the person that you married, that you trusted to never betray your trust. And now not only is he going to prison, your life is turned upside down. You have to explain this to your kids. You're going to be stuck holding the bag, trying to pay all the bills. And when they really start to open up, it's like this animal, this beast comes out of them where they unleash. Mm-hmm. And focusing on that now versus once somebody's in prison, it really does minimize the amount of resentment that's going to come down the road later. And it's very hard to hear that for a lot of individuals.
Are the women in denial? They must be on some level of denial, too, because you've got to, at some level, understand if your man's not quite there or...
Yeah, I think 50-50. I think some women are some of the housewives were very just off in la-la land, and they really just never asked anything. Some of them may have even been involved to a certain extent.
Right.
And then other ones immediately are filing divorce before the indictment even finishes coming down because they're jumping off the sinking ship.
Right.
So there's a wide range of emotions that come with this if it's not dealt with the right way.
I want to just point out to some of the listeners, when I was doing some of the research about RDAP, Residential Drug Abuse Program, and Dan, you're RDAP Dan, and that there was a big scandal up here in Connecticut in March, in March of 2019, so just this year, that there are firms that are – do you want to tell the story or you want me to tell the story? You probably tell it better. Do you?
Sure, I'll jump in there if you like. So yeah, there's a big organization called RDAP Law Consultants that have been around for several years. And they're basic, I guess, I don't even like putting them in the same category with us because they're really not. Their big thing is we guarantee to get you into RDAP and get you a year off.
Uh-huh.
So people will call them from their Google ads or wherever they find them and they'll ask them, hey, I saw your ad, how can you help me? They will literally coach you and tell you to pretend to have a substance abuse problem, to lie about your substance abuse use, to go get prescriptions for very, very specific drugs that will give you withdrawal symptoms as you're self-surrendering into the prison system, trying to get you into the RDAP program. So, because the RDAP program can obviously reduce your sentence, and everybody wants to get sentence reduction.
So they're actually coaching ineligible clients into the RDAP program. I read that they were having people show up to court intoxicated or fake withdrawal symptoms.
Yeah, and the crazy thing, Maureen, is They were doing this straight through email. They were emailing their clients to do this. I mean, they left such a nasty paper trail. It was to the point where it dates back now about two and a half years ago, I started receiving calls from individuals that found my YouTube channel, and they got a little bit nervous because I was talking about RDAP, and not everybody's going to qualify. You need to have a substance abuse problem. And more importantly, you need to have a substance abuse problem that's documented in your paperwork that's 12 months prior to your indictment. So RDAP Law Consultants is basically telling people to show up to prison drunk, which A, isn't going to do you any good anyway, because it's based on 12 months prior. So when they started telling me this, they started forwarding me the emails, and I'm reading these emails from RDAP Law Consultants, coaching clients to lie, to deceit, to lie to probation, pretending to have drug problems, people that have probably never sipped a can of beer in their life. So I started reaching out to the company and started telling them if they don't stop doing this, I'm going to start posting videos about them and what they're doing. And they didn't stop. So we started posting videos. We started reaching out to law enforcement. We had a bunch of clients that were out of Connecticut who ended up somehow getting the feds there involved. The feds reached out to me to get access to some of the videos and some of the voice recordings that I had recorded, and they were able to get an indictment for them. And the last guy, his name is Tony Pham, who went by a fake name, Ang Nguyen, he just pled guilty last week, and he's looking at quite a hefty sentence. Companies like that are the ones that give companies like what we do a really, really bad reputation, because then you start lumping them all together.
Okay, so Dan, what I want to do next in the last few minutes that we have here, you like the name of my business, right? Defy and Hustle Business Solution. Yeah. So you, when you were writing back to me, you were telling me, and I want you to, I guess I really do want you to inspire some of the people out there. You went from working at $10 an hour, you had come out of the prison system, and now you've built up this successful business and you live in a nice place in Florida. And so why don't you tell our listeners how to defy and hustle to build up your business, or how you did it?
Absolutely. So, yeah, when I released from prison in 2015, I had no driver's license. I had zero money to my name, no car, no place to live, no financial source of backing, no friends with money, no family with money. I didn't come from money. And I was literally living in a state I've never lived in before, riding a bus. You know, it sounded like something your grandfather would say. I used to go to work and take three buses uphill in the snow, but it was no joke. And I did this for almost a year. Every day, the thought crossed my mind. I could load up a rental car right now with a bunch of drugs and take a drive to Florida and probably cash in one big amount and be just fine. But my thinking kicked in and said, this is the kind of thought processing that got you into this place to begin with. So I slowly started to think, what can I do? How can I dig myself out of this hole? I was making a $10 an hour job, working about 30 hours a week. And after everything was said and done, I was paying child support. You know, I had less than $50 to my name at the end of every week. It really doesn't get you very far. So when I started growing this YouTube channel, I started realizing that nobody was going to do anything for me. And I was tired of making excuses for why I didn't have the things that I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I started putting value in myself, and I started looking at what my weaknesses were, because I knew what I was good at. I was good at sales. I was good at talking to people. I never doubted that. But my weaknesses were I would always try to find a shortcut. I'd always try to skip levels to get to the next part. And I started slowing down and taking my time and not quitting my day job while I was growing my business. So while I was making my YouTube channel, coming up with content, posting videos, I would come home at 11 o'clock at night, and I'd work till 4 or 5 in the morning, and then I'd get up at 7 o'clock and start the next day over and over again. I worked basically 24 hours a day for a little over a year, growing my business little by little, not listening to the naysayers. Everybody told me this wasn't going to work. There's no market for this. No one knows who you are. You know, you're not the white-collar guy. Successful people aren't going to trust you. Everything that somebody told me why I couldn't do it, I used as fuel and energy to feed the flame as to why I was going to do it, not just to prove everybody wrong, but to prove to myself that I had what it took. And here we are in 2019. You know, we came very close to doing $1 million in business this year. We have a couple of very nice cars. We live in a very, very nice area. We have money in the bank for the first time. I'm paying taxes like a legitimate citizen. I have child support is completely under control. I'm able to go on vacation. I'm able to do things that I never dreamed of being able to do, but it took hitting rock bottom and realizing that this is either going to be the absolute worst thing that ever happened to me, or this is going to be the absolute best thing that ever happened to me. And now the adversity that I face are people out there that want to tell me that I got lucky, or, oh, well, you just run a YouTube channel. You don't know what a real job is. I look at those people and I don't say anything, because you can't change somebody's mind. I look for the people that are like-minded, that want to be successful, that want to change their mindset. And those are the type of people that we work with and what we embrace in our friendships, our relationships, holding each other accountable. People helping people, communities method. And that's our motto, and that's what we stick to.
It really comes down to knowing yourself and having integrity, right? Because self-deceit is really when you've got one part of you that's healthy, that's telling you what you should be doing, and then there's something else that's, I don't know, I want to say on the darker side, that's taking you off in a different direction towards a fantasy.
You know, I tell people all the time, Lorene, that my dark demon, mm-hmm. he's still there. He has not gone anywhere. The difference is now is I keep him in my vision. I see where he is at all times, and I always look down to my left, and there's my little dark demon down there doing push-ups, ready to strike. The minute I fall weak and the minute I'm not paying attention, I know that little dark demon right there. So I have to constantly hold myself accountable. I have to constantly ask myself, are you doing things for the right reason? When I go to bed at night, if I know that I'm doing things for the right reason, I also know that everything else is going to fall into place as it should be. When you think you have it all together, when you get complacent and you stop thinking you need anybody else's help to solve your own problems, that's when our demons and our dark side can resurface. And once they get hold of you, it's very hard to fight them off. So you have to constantly work at it. Any addict will tell you the same thing. Sex addicts, drug addicts, whatever they're in addiction to, you can't go have one drink. You can't go just start doing things here and there. It's either all or nothing. And for me, I know how I am, and I know how easy I could go back to something that I shouldn't do, that every day I wear my RDAP Dan bracelet that I was given to me in prison in the program. And I look down on it, and it's a constant reminder of the work that I had to put in to get to where I am today. And it would be such a shame if I were to make such a poor decision that I could throw it all away just like that.
And surround yourself with healthy people, too, right?
People, places, and things.
Right? They say look around at the people around you. If you're trying to achieve something, see who's – if you're trying to start a company, look at the people around you and see if they're – running companies or capable or managing their money. If you're looking for love, look at some of the people around you and see if they're achieving that. So
it's amazing. Just today we were given an opportunity. We went and spoke at a state college to a corrections class on these individuals that are up and coming correctional officers. They had us come in and speak to them about a perspective from an inmate as to what correction staff could do to better increase the communication between inmates and staff. So the opportunities are endless.
On that note, Dan, we're at the end, right, Bob? So we're going to have to wrap it up. But that was Dan Wise. This is Dan Wise from Federal Prison Time Consulting, LLC, and RDAP Dan on YouTube. Thank you so much for being on the show, Dan, and good luck to you out there.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. Have a great evening.
Bye-bye. Bye, everybody. I'll talk to you soon enough. Merry Christmas. The boy can
The Voice of Greenwich. This is 1490 WGCH Greenwich.
Transform one room or the whole home. Mitsubishi Electric Cooling and Heating. Make yourself comfortable.
Bell Simons Companies is New England's premier wholesale distributor of Mitsubishi Electric Cooling and Heating and proud sponsor of UConn Athletics. Big Y World Class Market is proud to be the broadcast booth sponsor of UConn Men's Basketball. Whether it's a meal for two or setting up a feast for the whole team, stop by your local Big Y for it all. Stop by the Wing Bar for fresh, ready-to-eat wings and all your favorite flavors.